You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 28th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On today's show...
We're asking people to be sensible, only fill up when your car actually needs filling up, and this would then resolve itself.
Or so the UK government hopes. But can supply chain issues really be resolved so easily? We'll drill down into what's rapidly looking like a looming winter of discontent for Britain. Then Tunisia, once the poster child for the Arab Spring, is spiralling into chaos. We'll look at what went wrong. Donald Trump has a son called Eric. Might his French namesake, Eric Zemmour, be following in Trump Sr.'s footsteps? We'll investigate just who this far-right former TV show host and possible contender for France's leadership really is and how credible his prospects are. Then we'll cross to Canada, where the COVID crisis in Alberta is worsening and impacting on the political landscape. We'll flick through the papers, get a hit of urbanism news, and also we'll hear from the director of Daniel Craig's last Bond film.
As the day kind of went on, then we're getting closer and closer to that final take. Watching the crew members around me just breaking into tears, especially those around Daniel.
So, it's Godwin, Georgina Godwin, and that's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Germany's Green Party and the Free Democrats said they'll hold talks before meeting with the Social Democrats and the Christian Democratic Union, the two parties competing for their support to form coalition governments. North Korea's rubber-stamped legislature, the Supreme People's Assembly, will convene for one of its rare parliamentary sessions today. And hospitals in New York are expecting to lay off thousands of workers as a result of a new requirement that healthcare employees must be vaccinated against COVID-19. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, 90% of petrol stations in the UK have run dry due to chronic delivery problems, causing an enormous knock-on effect across all sectors. The healthcare system appears to be crumbling. A combination of price rises, tax increases and benefit cuts will leave the poorest British families £1,000 out of pocket. And there seems to be no viable opposition as the Labour Party descends into chaos. The UK is a mess. Does Boris Johnson's government have a plan? Well, I'm joined by Vincent McAvaney, Monocle 24's political correspondent, to investigate that. Vinny, let's start with fuel. You've been in Yorkshire talking to a haulage company. The root of this problem is the shortage of drivers. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's right. I spent yesterday morning with a haulage company just outside of Bradford. They do haulage right around the UK. They have 42 big 18-wheelers and they deliver all kinds of things. I spoke to a couple of drivers, guys who have done this for decades, and they said you just cannot get young people into this profession, that they don't want that lifestyle anymore. You know, when you climb into one of these trucks that I was in yesterday, it has a fridge stocked with food for the week so they can at least try and eat healthily. It has a microwave, it has a bed. And they will drive up and down the country, they will sleep in that cab. But the problem is, as well, on top of that, they don't have access to proper facilities because there are currently around 15,000 spaces short for them to park at service stations in the UK. So they end up often sleeping on slipways on the sides of roads, and then there are no facilities for them. So it is a very strange lifestyle that some of these guys live, and something that younger men, more used to being at home, more used to having a work-life balance, wanting to see wives and kids, they don't want to do that anymore. So there are real problems. And I think from talking to these guys, they think that no matter what money that is kind of thrown at the industry for the drivers, if you don't improve in those services, you're not really going to attract anyone else. And the boss of the company was herself a woman, and she's tried everything to get women in. And she says that until those service stations become secure and safe, because they have been attacked by criminal gangs trying to steal from these lorries, and until the facilities are nice enough, you're not going to get more people into this profession.
So what measures have the government put in place to alleviate this?
Well, that is the problem. The government is kind of trying to put in some short-term solutions at the moment to deal with this. So they've invited some 5,000 European drivers to come back to the UK, but only for 3 months. They'll have to leave by Christmas Eve. And yesterday I said to the boss of this company, well, have you had any European drivers call? And she said, no, of course we're not going to, because many of them have gone back. They've now taken up jobs in their home countries or elsewhere in the EU. Why would they give that up to come here? Where would they stay for just 3 months? And then they would go back on Christmas Eve, when last year they were, many of them, stuck at an airfield down in Dover without any kind of support or services, unable to cross again because of the chaos at the port. So that is one way. We know that an army section is being put on standby in order to drive fuel to the pumps just in case, but that hasn't been activated yet. And we've seen the fuel price as a result spiking to its highest level in 8 years. I was at four different service stations yesterday, which had all run out. And there was genuine bewilderment and anger from people at what was happening, at why the government hadn't foreseen this crisis was coming, when about 20,000 EU drivers have left because of Brexit, with the DVLA, which is the roads agency in the UK, unable to process tests and new licenses during the whole pandemic period. There was real concern as to why the government hadn't foreseen this coming.
And also concern that with loosening of various rules, like it being easier to get an HGV license for drivers, being allowed to drive for longer with shorter breaks. I mean, that's real safety concerns.
Oh, completely. And this is something that the company that I was with yesterday and another company in London on Friday said, is that these reforms are not correct. They will make the roads less safe. Drivers already, you know, drive long hours, and they have to I don't think many people get this, that many of them have to load the vehicles themselves, which can be demanding physical work, then get in the cab, drive for 5 or so hours to a site where they'll then have to wait. They'll then have to unload it themselves. Then they might have to go onto another site, unload again, and then drive back to base. Or if the hours run out, just pull into a lay-by and get some sleep. So, you know, this is really physical work. Extending the hours is not, they say, going to help this problem. It's about investing in the services to get younger people in. And when I said to many of them, you know, I was in one of these vans yesterday driving around, and it is a huge vehicle. You really have to get to know the physics of how the articulated movement works. What the government's idea is that they're going to change it so that if you can drive what they call the category 2 vehicles, which are kind of vans, which are delivery vans, which are fixed. So if you imagine the cabin, there's then no kind of gap between the box at the back, which holds all the goods. So it moves in one kind of simple way. They're talking about changing it so you can go straight from a car. Normally you have to do a bit of time in that vehicle first, but going straight from a car into an articulated, where you've got a cabin that's separate, you have to learn how to dock it on, there's a gap, and then it moves in a slightly different manner when you're taking corners. They say that is a recipe for disaster, that it'll make the roads less safe, and that it really shouldn't be done.
Now, we're seeing this impact, obviously, on the fuel situation, but it must also be impacting other sectors. We're running up to Christmas. Demand is just going to increase for deliveries. What do you foresee happening?
I think the events of this weekend are going to trigger off a wave across the economy, really, of panic buying. I think you're going to have businesses that are going to start to increase the amount that they have in terms of the supplies that they need. So I think, you know, this kind of the model that we've got in the UK is this just-in-time model, is that, say, a car garage. So I was needed to put my car in last week. They were having trouble getting parts for the repairs, and said that something that should have come down in about 48 hours would then take now about 12 days. So I think you might start to see some businesses start to up the amount of supplies and resources that they have. And then on the consumer side, what you're going to see is people now, after this fuel panic, we're going to see them starting to think ahead to Christmas. I think we're going to start to see them sort of start to stockpile food again. And we had already seen some shelves start to empty out, and supermarkets saying that they were going to reduce their range. we're going to start seeing as well, I think, a bit of a rush on toys, maybe electrical goods as well, people trying to get things in before Christmas so that they don't miss out.
Vinny, we know this is also going to impact across the NHS, which is already struggling, the National Health System, with all sorts of transport logistics being a problem there. We know there's an energy crisis where huge price rises are on the cards. There's a financial fallout due to COVID. The poorest Britons are set to get poorer. And I wonder if the British people think that a change in government at the next election might solve these problems. Now, the opposition Labour Party conference is going on at the moment, but it seems that it's mired in infighting. Is there any hope that a change in administration will alleviate any of these problems?
Yeah, well, you know, you hit on all those things there. And many people, you know, said in August, you know, oh, it's, you know, Afghanistan, the withdrawal, this is really going to damage the government. But when it comes to foreign affairs, they happen in a very different way and impact people differently. And whilst many people were shocked and had a lot of sympathy and were angry, nothing hits voters like a hit to their wallets. It is at all times the closest thing to them, and it affects equally everyone across society. Not to the same degree, but everyone notices it. Everyone is noticing prices are rising, that products aren't in shops, that for the first time in many people's lifetimes in the UK, that their choices are being limited and impacted, and that they are really starting to see huge spikes. You know, even myself, my energy company, it seems, is on the verge of collapse. Several have already collapsed. Now, people are automatically, whatever tariff they've negotiated, being swapped to another company on a much higher tariff, and they're starting to feel this energy price hit. So they've got the gas prices at the petrol stations, they've got energy prices going up, they've got stagnation in wages despite house prices continuing to rise. You've got really now a full circle impact on people's life chances. You've also got a tax increase coming. Normally the thing that you can rely on with a Conservative government is that your taxes won't go up. But they are going to go up here to pay for the social care of the elderly. So that is going to go up. And yesterday they slipped out, the government, an announcement that the amount of money that you make to start having to pay back your student loan will fall from £27,000 to about £23,000. So you are now really starting to pile the burden onto younger generations. So yes, there I think is going to be a building sense of anger through the winter that, well, now that we've got through this crisis, the government perhaps is struggling to address the needs of the people, that it hasn't got on top. We'll see with this reshuffle. This was a team that was meant to deliver. Whether they take action, there is a budget coming in a few weeks' time, but we'll see how proactive this government gets. So many people at this time will naturally think, well, what is the alternative? And the main opposition party here is the Labour Party. They're having their conference down in Brighton. But so far, it had over the weekend been embroiled with an argument about its internal rules. Now, the Labour leader surprisingly managed to get through what he wanted. He thinks he's basically stopped a Jeremy Corbyn from coming by changing the rules on who gets to vote for the leader. They wanted yesterday to push on with their agenda to sell to the public, and they were hit by a resignation by a frontbencher, Andy McDonald. He resigned over the Labour Party opposing a proposal from supporters to campaign for a minimum wage of £15 an hour. Now, Keir Starmer's team think that's simply too much. The current minimum wage is just over £8 an hour. The party position is to go to about £10. But this just shows more infighting in the party.
Yeah, absolutely. Vincent, thank you very much indeed. That's Vincent McAvinny there. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. In 2011, a revolution in Tunisia triggered the Arab Spring, and the country was hailed as a beacon of democracy. But now, after the president, Kais Saied, gave himself power to rule by decree, 2 months after he sacked the prime minister, suspended parliament and assumed executive authority, several thousand people have demonstrated against him in the biggest show of public anger since his coup. Well, joining me is Alizia Volkman, a freelance journalist based in Tunis. Alizia, thanks for coming on. How has Tunisia reached this point since the heady days of 2011? What happened to the democratic gains?
The big problem in Tunisia has been a downward spiral in terms of Well, it's been negative economic development, unfortunately. There's been a lot of problems within Parliament because the sort of complicated list system has meant that there's never been a majority party. So one of the big problems politically is that you've just had this very kind of rambunctious politics of point scoring within the Assembly, and not the type of results that Tunisians would have liked to have seen. During the era of Ben Ali, I mean, he profited from the boom time in the late 90s and the, you know, the early noughties. His reign came to an end because of the economic crisis. So the thing is that Tunisians were, you know, they were repeatedly demonstrating pretty much every single December and January. There were major demonstrations in the street, particularly this year. I mean, it was very hot and angry, you know, the mood on the street. It wasn't just, you know, the regular street demonstrations. There were a lot of riots within the poorer neighborhoods, like places like Hayat al-Daman, where literally, you know, young men were setting the streets on fire. So there's been a real sort of pressure cooker building in Tunisia, particularly over the last year, because we've had the pandemic, which has really, you know, really pushed down the economy. It's pushed down living standards. Of course, globally, you know, food prices, you know, petrol prices, cost of living are going up. And for, you know, a sort of a middle to lower income state like Tunisia, they, you know, people just can't absorb that kind of pressure.
Yep. We've seen a lot of protests this weekend, but I wonder how much support Saeed actually has.
This is one of the big questions, because when, you know, when he assumed power on July 25th, it seemed to be a very popular move. But I was at the demonstration at Bardo, and it was actually very small. And we were, you know, my colleagues and I were sort of saying, well, what's actually really going on? Because we don't recognize anybody. It wasn't the usual movement of activists, of leftists, of students. And as I walked around, they were very middle class people. They weren't from the usual neighborhoods, you know, who would sort of come out and protest about the poverty. These were middle class, educated people. They were teachers. They were people, a lot of people from the pharmacy industry. There was one student, but he was a business student. So it was an odd situation, and at most only about 100 people. And the thing that we do know as journalists is that if you're filming on a camera phone, you can make things look busier than they really are. So there were, you know, reports of demonstrations all over the country, and certainly there was an attack on the, you know, the party offices of the leading party Ennahda, which is the Muslim Democrats in Tozo. But we don't really know exactly how big those demonstrations were. And certainly the initial reaction was one of jubilation, because, you know, they'd been in this political deadlock. What Kais Saied was promising was release from that deadlock, that, you know, somehow magically things were going to change.
Mm. I wonder how much support he has outside of the country and what the wider implications are for the region.
Well, in terms of support, it's mostly coming from the east. What we do know, and is, you know, is reported, is that there's a new military alliance or military cooperation deal between Tunisia and Egypt, which is very concerning, because the axis of Egypt, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and I'm afraid France have been, you know, basically sort of stoking instability in the region. They were behind, you know, General Haftar's attack, which caused nearly a sort of 2-year war in Libya, which has only just settled down. And what's really concerning is that things are sort of rumbling again, and that Kais Saied, who's got quite an irascible personality, has been at loggerheads with Dbeibah, the Prime Minister of Libya. So we are concerned. However, Algeria, which is probably, you know, it's the biggest country in Africa, they are very worried about Tunisia. Other countries, they're supportive of Tunisia, the state, but not of Kais mm-hmm. Saied. So things that are indicative are actually boycotts. So there's supposed to be a Francophonie meeting in Djerba soon, and African states are boycotting it. There was a tacit boycott following a sort of a military exercise with the EU, and normally there's a sort of, you know, drinks due afterwards, and the majority of European embassies did not show up.
Elysia, thank you very much indeed. That's Elysia Volkman there in Tunis. Now, still to come on the programme, we look at the new far-right possible candidate for the French leadership, examine the healthcare crisis in Alberta, Canada, and...
As the day kind of went on, then we're getting closer and closer to that final take, watching the crew members around me just breaking into tears, especially those around Daniel.
This is Globalist, The Globalist. Do stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We turn to France now, where Eric Zemmour, the far-right television pundit, is consolidating his position as a contender for the country's election next year. He hasn't yet officially declared his candidacy, but polls indicate he could win 11% of votes in the first round of the April ballot. So who is he, and what might his candidacy mean for France? Well, joining me here in the studio is Philippe Marlier, a professor of French and European politics at UCL. Welcome to Midori House, Philippe.
Good morning.
Who is Eric Zemmour and what's his background?
Well, first of all, he is not a common traditional politician. He was never elected before. He's a media man. He's a pundit, essayist. He writes books, which sells well, to be fair. And yes, he's been, over the past 10 years or so, rapidly becoming a kind of household name, you know, by sort of being extremely present in the media. He writes in Le Figaro newspaper. He has a number, participates in a number of TV programs, notably on CNews. So he's a man which a lot of French people know by now, which explains his popularity. Of course, he's an extremely polarized figure. Some people like him, others hate him. And because his views on politics at large are extremely polarized and controversial.
So what are his policies?
Well, I think people in France, commonly left and right, place him on the far right, so that we are not talking here about a mainstream person. So he's a man without a party. Essentially, the themes are which he bangs on continuously are Islam and immigration, which, of course, when you sort of... your political programs or political ideas are mostly focused on that. It is, of course, places you not on the left or the centre. He is a far-right politician, which explains that, by the way, his 11% in the latest polls clearly seems to bite into Marine Le Pen's electorate. Mm-hmm. So that's also mm-hmm. another sign that he competes with her, but also into a more traditional conservative electorate. So essentially, these are the two themes. He recently debated with the radical left, populist left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon on TV, so which is also a sign of recognition when, you know, a major candidate for the election on the left decides to go on TV and debate for 2 hours. And essentially, yes, the themes revolved around that, two conceptions of Frenchness and of a French society, one open, Mélenchon, and the other one, which is essentially espousing the theme of the Great Replacement, which, you know, is now in the world, a theory, a so-called theory, which is now held by a white supremacist, which says essentially that Europe, to start with, and France, here in our case, will be the allogene population will be progressively replaced by people coming from Africa, and in the case of France, from former colonies in Maghreb. So that, hence the obsession about Islam, which allegedly, according to Zemmour, is not compatible with French values. And the idea that, yes, at some point the French population will no longer be French, but be something different.
Just looking at his career trajectory and his views, can he be compared with Donald Trump?
To some extent, yes, because Trump came from business initially, but you could also argue he's a kind of a media creature, because I think the French media probably have a lot of to answer for about Zemmour. You know, despite being condemned 3 times for incitation to racial hatred, he's still employed by media outlets in France. So I think there's a lot of controversy and also lots of discussion going on in France about we made him, we made that person. It's also a sign of a political void in French politics and disarray, the fact that the left is in disarray, the conservative right doesn't do much better. So there are gaps which Zemmour exploits, really, without any party, without any popular backing. He's able, through the media, literally, to convey and his ideas, which are extremely controversial. Or those ideas wouldn't have had any airtime just 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that shows also how remarkably all French political debates have shifted to the right.
Do you think that he will run? And if so, I mean, the polls are saying 11%, perhaps. What are his chances?
He knows whether, or he knows, maybe he doesn't know yet whether he's going to run. I think he's sort of patiently waiting. Anyway, the media absolutely are sort of crazy. He's constantly in the news. So I think he will wait until the moment when probably he will sort of feel that, yes, he can sort of run and get a good score. I don't think he thinks he can win it, but at least that's what he does. And frankly, you know, given the sort of attention paid to him, he doesn't have to declare himself too early. So we'll see, you know. But it could be, yes, a kind of Trumpian candidacy, in a sense that without any background in politics, without any former experience, he's, to be fair, also, he's a much better debater than Trump. He's more articulate. He's a man who, although he's historians, philosophers, of course, are very prompt to say that he makes a lot of errors. But he's also someone who has some kind of pretension to be sort of well-read, and that's why it's a bit of a different figure.
Yeah. You've mentioned that he could possibly take votes away from Marine Le Pen, the other prominent far-right candidate, but could he also be a credible rival to the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron?
It's too early to tell. I think clearly one needs really to know exactly what will be the field. I think we don't know exactly yet. Macron will probably run again. Le Pen is a candidate. On the left, we know that we've got Mélenchon also, who came fourth last time. It will depend very much on the field. But, you know, the state of French politics is so volatile that, yes, there could be a surprise similar to Trump's election. You know, no one saw Trump coming and win that election until the very last moment. And I think it is possible. It is unlikely, I would say, today, but it is possible.
Philippe, thank you very much indeed. That's Philippe Marlier. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Germany's Greens and the Free Democrats, two parties set to become kingmakers in any coalition that may emerge after the country's federal election, said they will hold talks before meeting the two parties competing for their support. The left-leaning Social Democrats narrowly beat the centre-right Christian Democratic Union in Sunday's vote. North Korea's rubber-stamped legislature, the Supreme People's Assembly, will convene for one of its rare parliamentary sessions today. Adjustments to the National Economic Plan is on the agenda. The country's dictator, Kim Jong-un, has admitted that the COVID-19 pandemic has caused severe hardship. Hospitals in New York are expecting to lay off thousands of workers as a result of the new mandate requiring all healthcare employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Those who fail to comply with this mandate will be placed on unpaid leave. In anticipation of staff shortages, New York's new governor, Kathy Hochul, is considering bringing in the National Guard as well as vaccinated workers from other states. And today's Monocle Minute marks the release of No Time to Die, the 25th installment of the James Bond franchise. The long-awaited film will finally open in cinemas this week after many delays due to the pandemic. More on this on the show ahead. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Back in June, the Premier of the Canadian province of Alberta, Jason Kenney, declared that Alberta was open for business, ahead of what he said would be the best summer ever. Well, over this past weekend, intensive care units in the province's hospitals saw a record number of patients admitted to be treated for COVID-19, with the health system now completely overwhelmed. And many people are saying the Premier and his office are responsible for the current situation. Sheena Rossiter is Monocle's contributing editor in Edmonton and joins me on the line now. Sheena, first of all, I wonder if you could just give us a sense of how bad the situation has become.
Yes, exactly. Well, Alberta has had the most COVID-19 cases in all of Canada by far in this fourth wave that we're going through right now. And it's actually one of the hot spots in North America. So let's just look at the numbers. As of yesterday, active COVID-19 cases in the province of Alberta reached more than 21,000. More than 5,000 of those cases were just confirmed over the weekend. And more than 1,000 people are in the hospital with COVID-19. 265 of those patients are in the ICU. Now, where this really matters, and this is where the healthcare system is getting overloaded and overwhelmed, it's those patients in the ICU. The number just keeps growing. Most of those patients are unvaccinated. So what the province has had to do is they've had to open up surge bed capacity. So basically closing down operating rooms and using those as intensive care units in order to accommodate the increasing number of patients that need the ICU. But if those surge beds weren't even put into place, the ICU capacity would be sitting at 180%. And this is the most stress that the intensive care units across the province have ever been in the history of the healthcare system. So the healthcare system's just completely overwhelmed. It's been on the brink of collapse for weeks now, and non-essential surgeries just keep getting canceled. So that includes everything like cancer patients, they can't get surgeries that they need, and other serious conditions. So medical staff here, they're starting to implement triage measures. And what that means is basically if there's two patients and one ventilator available, they're going to be forced to see who is more likely to survive will get that ventilator. Medical staff, they're just completely overwhelmed, burnt out, and many professionals are quitting or leaving the province due to the conditions. So the situation in the healthcare system is pretty dire due to the fourth wave.
So Kenny has said another lockdown would only punish vaccinated people. Is there any other way forward?
Yeah, so over the weekend, he did speak on a local radio station, and he did say this. The province had mandated a vaccine passport. That's in place now through Kenny, although Jason Kenny has fallen short of actually calling it a vaccine passport, since many voters in his base don't want a vaccine passport, fearing that, quote unquote, that would limit their freedoms. And with the COVID-19 cases rising here more than ever before, more than the previous three waves, it doesn't seem possible to not have what some people are calling for, a fire break. So what a fire break is basically meaning just another lockdown. And on Sunday evening, several Alberta doctors did write a letter to the newly appointed health minister asking for this fire break. What they said in the letter is they basically said that there needs to be another lockdown in order to prevent disease, death, and suffering. And the numbers have been high in terms of death. Up to 29 people in a 24-hour period have been dying in the province. And yesterday on Twitter, hashtag firebreakAB, AB meaning Alberta, was trending. A lot of people are talking about this. So another lockdown is being called for by medical professionals. But realistically, based on Jason Kenney and his conservative stance and his policies, he's been adamant about keeping the economy open for businesses. So it's hard to say if that will actually happen or not. And based on what he said over the weekend on local radio, it doesn't sound like he will implement another lockdown.
So how big a role do you think that the situation in Alberta played in the federal election?
It played a very, very big role. And you could really see that across the country, the Conservatives lost the most votes actually in Alberta compared to what they had in the last election in 2019. So usually Alberta is a Conservative stronghold. I should start by explaining just a little bit of background here. So the province, the political power in Alberta, it's called the United Conservative Party, which is different from the Federal Conservative Party, the Conservative Party of Canada. But the Federal Conservatives are very much in line with the UCP, and the Premier of Alberta, Jason Kenney, he is a member of the Federal Conservative Party. So during the last election in 2019, Jason Kenney was out and he was helping the federal leader at that time on the campaign trail. However, things weren't looking so good this time, and people were clearly not happy with how the pandemic has been dealt with and how the chief medical officer in Alberta has admitted fault in reopening and lifting restrictions too early. So when voters went to the polls during this past election, some people did see Kenney's actions reflected in how the federal conservatives might be dealing with the pandemic if they came to power. And you could definitely see that because actions spoke louder than words, and the support for the Conservative Party fell by 14% in Alberta in this most recent election. And that was definitely down compared to the last election and three seats flipped over to different parties in this province. So since the fourth wave really started, it really hit the province just before Election Day. It was really fresh on voters' minds when they hit the polls just over a week ago.
Sheena, thank you very much indeed. That's Sheena Rossiter there on the line from Edmonton, Alberta in Canada. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is Alessia Patilano, who's a senior lecturer in war studies at King's College London. Alessia, many thanks for coming into the studio.
Good morning, Georgina.
I know that one of your specialisms is marine war or marine military manoeuvres. And this is what we've been seeing in the Taiwan Strait, as reported by The Times.
Yes. So one of the stories that was covered is this transit through the Straits of Taiwan, which is considered an international strait, and so technically it should be just fine to sail through. And HMS Richmond, which is one of the destroyers, one of the frigates that was that is part of the Carrier Strike Group 21, finishing up things in the East China Sea, where it was conducting a number of exercises, visits, and also participated to the implementation of UN sanctions on ship-to-ship transfer of illicit material in regards to North Korea. So they were coming down from the East China Sea and now they're heading towards Vietnam, and they decided to go through the Straits of Taiwan, which of course
China's furious.
Yeah. Exactly. And but yes, the Chinese are furious, and they make a point about that. They called the British decision to sail through the Straits as indicative of their evil intention. So the language is right in Chinese sense, you know, the classic type of language that you would see. Now, were they as furious as the sort of headlines would suggest? Well, not particularly if you put it in context, right? If you put it in context, the reaction was very much aligned with the type of reaction we've seen when the United States does it, when France has done it. So I didn't think there was anything transpiring, indicating that they were particularly furious at the Brits. But it is an important thing, and it shows also that. So if you consider that the only other time it was done was by HMS Enterprise in 2019, and that's a survey ship, and then before that you have to sort of peel your way back to 2008 when HMS Kent did it. So there's been quite a bit of a gap. And what it tells us is two things, really. One, CSG has been sort of out there in the Indo-Pacific as part of the integrated review, indication of recalibration towards the region in terms of engagement. It's done lots of things. And because the group included a number of ships and the submarine, then it disaggregated and different components did different things. So it's interesting that the frigate did that. And the second point is that the action itself speaks of a willingness of the British government to be more visible on some of the key geopolitical questions of today. And in this particular case, sort of signaling really that the increased tensions across the Straits have reached the level that it really is not acceptable, and certainly trying to send join the number of other countries that are trying to sort of suggest to China that the level of tensions that we've seen over the last 18 months going up across the Strait, it's certainly not desirable.
Mm. Well, of course, China does have one great ally, and that's North Korea, who have very interestingly chosen to do what's probably a test flight, coinciding absolutely with the with UNGA, with the United Nations General Assembly, and the speech from North Korea. Tell us more about this, as reported in Al Jazeera.
Right. So this has been, again, widely reported, and as you can imagine, particularly sort of big newspapers in the Asia Pacific region, they've been very keen to report that this is the third test in as many weeks. The North Koreans have been busy. Of course, when you give a speech, an important speech, you always want to have a little bit of firework. They went literal on this one. And what we know is there was a single missile that was tested, fired from inland in one of the sort of northern area launching facilities. It didn't fly too far, dropped in the waters, heading towards, again, the Japanese archipelago. What was interesting was the slightly different reactions. The Japanese government was quite clear in suggesting that it was a ballistic missile, although the trajectory, as we know as of now, does not necessarily indicate that. And if it is, it might have been like a failed test. Whereas the South Korean government has been much more cautious. Here, I think there is a question of the North Koreans really trying to make a statement about the fact that there is business as usual, that the country is carrying on, and they're open for business, politically speaking, with South Korea, yeah, but they want to do it on equal terms. Mm. And so this idea of projecting power and strength is very much part of that package, of that sort of projecting of, yeah, we're here to talk, but be careful because we're going to defend ourselves and we're here to do that.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, of course, the Supreme People's Assembly convenes today for one of its rare parliamentary sessions. Let's stay in the region and go to Japan because there are questions about what the 100th Prime Minister must bring with him for the nation's future.
Absolutely. So this is an excellent piece in the Nikkei that really, for anyone, so this is an important election. And if you want to, the election in Japan is a little bit like elections in Germany, because Japan is at the centre of a number of bilateral and multilateral economic, political, military formations and pacts and agreements. So it is one of the pivotal players in what is de facto one of the most sort of defining parts of the world in today's international politics. So much like the attention given to Germany, one wants to sort of pay attention to what is happening in Japan. And really what we are looking at is an election that will need a charismatic leader, one that will be able to carry on structural reform, particularly the health sector, and then also in terms of international political commitment. So interesting thing, excellent piece to have an up-to-date understanding about where we are today.
Finally, what size jeans do you wear?
Apparently the same one that when I was 21, which is the key thing, a study tells us. Otherwise, it would be terrible in terms of managing type 2 diabetes. Apparently they say that if a BMI, or your body mass fat sort of is not too dissimilar to when you were younger, you will be capable of managing or avoiding risk of diabetes much better than otherwise. I thought, though, that it was very interesting that the key, the principal investigator of this research made specific reference that if you can still wear your jeans from when you were young, you're doing just fine, or you're more likely to sort of tackle this question than others. Very evocative image, if you ask me, perhaps frightening for some, but certainly something that sort of makes you pay attention to what's in the research.
Absolutely. I was trying to think back and wondering if that was true for me. And I think at 21, I was on the stage every night in playing the lead in a play called The Tart and the Vicar's Wife. And now in my 50s, I sit behind a microphone on my fat ass, largely sedentary. So I think that probably answers the question in itself. Alessia, thank you very much indeed. And might I say, what a good look those jeans are. That was Alessia Patilano of King's College London. And this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Now, this week sees the highly anticipated release of the new James Bond movie, No Time to Die, which has been pushed back by over a year due to the pandemic. This is the 25th Bond film and marks the final appearance of Daniel Craig as 007. On this week's Monocle on Culture, Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the film's director, Kerry Joji Fukunaga.
How did you bring kind of James Bond to a 2021 audience as well? Was there kind of any updates perhaps in the character, or you didn't want to change it too much?
I think it was definitely impossible to ignore the Me Too element that we'd been living with when we wrote this screenplay. There's no way to not sort of address the fact that the world is changing, the office place is changing, the dynamics everywhere are changing, and it's, you know, about time. So that is definitely a part of the story, but like we also were aware you can't be reactionary. You can't act like, you know, a corporation might, and, you know, put a, you know, a stamp on something, acting like you're doing something. It has to be sort of like tangible within the context of the story. It has to make sense, and it has to feel like it's real and taken seriously. And I think part of that, you know, Barbara Broccoli is one of the most, or the most successful female producer. And from the 90s, when Judi Dench was brought in to play M, there was a change already taking place with the character where she calls out the misogyny in that film. So Daniel's run as Bond has continued that legacy of evolution. And I think bringing on female 00s and really fleshing out the female characters throughout the series, you know, Vesper Lynd, I think, was a very fleshed out character in the first film, has been the franchise's response to the changing world.
And I was going to ask, you know, what's the most exciting part of directing a Bond movie? Because you're mentioning, of course, the more importance to female characters, but I believe even Daniel Craig, he portrayed more emotion as well. So I think it's not only about the big, exciting action scenes as well. There's quite a lot of kind of emotionally depth to the character as well. But what was the most exciting parts of directing such a, you know, a large budget film like No Time to Die?
It was hard to kind of stop and take stock of the moment. I think we were definitely in it for most of the run of production because it was just there was never any time. As the title says. I think some of the more exciting moments were when you got a second to sort of pinch yourself and realize, you know, what you were doing, whether it was when like the fancy cars came up or, you know, just watching Daniel, you know, as Bond do something that felt so quintessentially Bond. You know, in those moments, you're able to kind of appreciate it. But then obviously all the weight of the things that were left to be done would come crashing back in. And then you're back in work mode.
And Kerry, was Bond something that you always wanted to do? Or was it a bit of surprise when you were kind of invited to direct a No Time to Die? And I wonder what was your reaction as well?
Well, I had actually sought out Barbara for a drink shortly after Spectre came out. And at that time, Daniel was saying that was his last Bond. So in my mind, they're probably looking for somebody else in a restart. And so I just sort of raised my hand and said, you know, when you get to that point, I'd like to be considered. And then I sort of forgot about it. I went on to do another series and that became all engrossing. And when I had finished that series and was about to promote it is when I read that Danny Boyle was dropping out. So again, I emailed Barbara and said, what's going on here? Can I still be, you know, considered for this role? And that led to a meeting at Barbara's house in New York with Michael and Daniel, and then more meetings and more story meetings. And suddenly I was doing the job. It was kind of a blur, actually. It happened so quickly.
Well, knowing a little bit of your work, I'm very excited to see what you bring, you know, to No Time to Die. And let's be honest here. I mean, some directors, they direct in more than one Bond movie. I mean, who knows? I mean, if you're invited for another one, would you say yes?
I would have to consider it. You know, I mean, I've never really done the same thing twice. So it's not so much for lack of passion or desire to shepherd the character forward even further, but it's more just, you know, with the limited time left that I have to make movies and television programs, I have to really be careful about what I choose, because there is only so much time.
You know, I felt one thing that I would like to ask, because of course I saw the documentary being James Bond, how emotional it was. Tell us about the environment in the set about that, because of course Daniel Craig last time, it was really emotional.
It was that last day of shooting was definitely more emotional than I anticipated. I'm not someone that usually gets teary-eyed on set, and the way you could feel, almost the way when you go to a movie and you can feel the room, you know, in a movie, if people are happy, people are crying, it's a contagious emotion. And on set, it was very much that feeling that day. You could feel, I remember getting out of the car and walking towards our Cuba streets, which is where we're doing our last day of shooting, and just feeling the weight of it. And then as the day kind of went on, then we're getting closer and closer to that final take, watching the crew members around me just breaking into tears, and especially those around Daniel. And then when we finally did our last take, you know, it was Daniel walking by the camera and then walking away from camera with his back to us. And we did a take, maybe I did a second take, and I was considering a third take, even though it's a pretty basic thing. There was nothing I needed him to do differently, but I just couldn't bring myself to say cut and say that's it. And then there we were, we cut, and everyone was waiting outside the doors for him to come back from the shot. And I think he was even surprised. I think we were all surprised about what it meant. And his words, you know, at the end there were really were very touching.
And that was Cary Joji Fukunaga, who's director of No Time to Die, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And you can hear the full interview ahead of the film's release on Thursday on a brand new episode of Monocle on Culture. And that's it. I am out of Bond lines for you. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. But Kat Hanna, we've been expecting you.
Good morning.
It's time to get the latest in urbanism news, and Kat is here in the studio with me. Kat, let's start in Barcelona, because this has been the only major European city to really clamp down on Airbnb, and it's gone even further now.
Yeah, absolutely. So Barcelona, I think, probably has often been, you know, one of the lead cities in, I guess, kind of tackling some of the negatives of Airbnb, and particularly kind of, you know, and also more generally the impact that a lot of tourism, you know, can have on actually a relatively kind of small city. And what they've nearly done now, this next step, you know, previously it was about needing a license if you were going to be able to rent out an entire property. That was done about 5 years ago. This next step is saying, actually, even if you want to just rent out one of your rooms, that's actually now really going to be forbidden. So it's really quite a dramatic next step. And, you know, the article kind of highlights, I guess, the tensions between being, you know, this ability to rent out a room, being obviously a source of income, you know, for a number of individuals. There's actually quite a staggering stat that, according to Airbnb, about half their hosts are actually relying on that income to pay bills. You could see that as a good thing. I think you could also perhaps see that as a bad thing, that actually, you know, it's really become that necessary. Mm. So there is a balance of obviously some of the financial benefits that it gives to individuals and those freedoms. But then again, how difficult it can actually be to really regulate when people are letting at just that single room level. And it looks at that's why they've kind of shifted, I guess, from a regulation approach of licenses essentially towards prohibition.
Mm. Because, I mean, Barcelona is really clamping down on tourism. They are just sick of people in their city.
Absolutely. And obviously, it's an interesting article, obviously, kind of coming post-COVID, where, well, more or less post, but, you know, at kind of looking again, you know, it's often seen to be a pre-COVID concern. You know, again, we saw it around 5 years ago in Barcelona, you know, anti-tourism protests. There was this feeling that actually this was kind of
ruining the city in terms of gentrification, in terms of overcrowding, in terms of impacts on, you know, prices for homes, but also for rent as well. So there was also this definite sense from residents of frustration. And then obviously with Ada Colau taking over as mayor, really actually quite a radical approach, you know, towards that regulation, as we're seeing now shift towards prohibition as well.
Mm. I mean, because Colau has done a lot of work fighting housing eviction. She's very left wing. She's taken a really hard line on tourism. And I just wonder how much of this is absolutely led by her and what it means really for residents of the city.
It's an interesting one. And there's a few examples with some residents who actually themselves, you know, have been letting out rooms, you know, through Airbnb. And I think the feeling of that most people would welcome regulation. You know, there was the feeling that actually, you know, if it becomes too much, it does have an impact on the overall city. You know, again, there was the article cites some research that in areas with kind of heavy Airbnb presence, you saw house prices increase by around 17%. Hmm. So, you know, there was a really tangible impact that was happening on residents. So you can understand that need for regulation. But actually, some of those interviewed said, look, this is maybe a step too far, and that full prohibition is a bit much.
Yeah.
The difficulty, though, again, like you said, is how do you regulate what can often be quite a grey area?
Yeah. Let's go to The Atlantic now, because this is a very interesting piece about the office and the office versus the home office, or how do you make an office more homely, and should you?
Absolutely. So this is quite a nice piece, kind of looking really, I guess, at the office and how it kind of reflects culture and economic history and social history as well. So obviously looking at, for example, the more traditional, if you say, think of a typical office perhaps in the 1980s, 1990s, very much about signalling prestige, quite formal, very much about saying we're white collar, we wear suits, and kind of having a decor that really reflected that, because it was often about distinguishing the office from a blue collar environment. And then kind of over the past 10 years ago, you know, the article highlights you've kind of seen this shift towards a bit of a more domestic feel. That might be soft furnishings, rugs, artwork, plants. And actually about thinking about how do employers actually want their office to feel? Do they want it to be inviting? Do they want it to be a bit more casual? But as the article kind of highlights, you know, I think one of the good quotes is this idea of, you know, the home office and the homey office are now ascendant at the same time. Mm-hmm. So actually at a time where maybe we already feel our home and work lives have become a bit too indistinguishable from one another, is that a trend we're going to continue to want to see when we want to go into the office? Or do we want to feel actually like we're going into a different environment and reintroducing a bit of that separation?
And it's so difficult, isn't it? You know, I have my laptop on my dining room table, and then it comes a certain point and it's got to move so we can eat there, and then it's straight back on the table and I'm working again. And you want some kind of definite separation, don't you?
Absolutely. But at the same time, there's also maybe an argument that people have got used to the more relaxed setting of working from home, and actually being able to have a bit of choice of spaces where you might work. If you want to go sit and do some reading, you might go do that on a sofa versus maybe going somewhere a bit more formal to take, you know, a very important phone call. So again, it's also about how can offices offer that choice and kind of spatial variety.
Yeah. And finally, let's look at, this is such an interesting article about free public drinking fountains in Turkey.
Yes, I absolutely loved this article. It kind of had a lot in it because there was quite a lot of history, really looking back at, you know, the role of philanthropists, particularly in Turkey, so the Ottoman Empire, in terms of, you know, the philanthropic duty of providing free drinking water. Mm-hmm. And it was similarly the case in London, and in a number of kind of US cities as well, but obviously highlighting that, you know, without the right maintenance, a lot of these facilities, you know, fall into disrepair. But actually, you know, in Istanbul, there's been a big focus on actually bringing back, you know, these fountains, getting them working again. They've restored 40 over the past year. I think the plan is to keep doing that, you know, each year. And what was quite nice about the article was really highlighting that, yes, this is partly about water, but it's also about a meeting place. It's also about public health, you know, it's also about the environment and urging people not to go away and just buy a load of plastic bottles as well. And really actually thinking about, you know, the role that actually something like that can play in having a more livable city.
Yeah, free water as a hallmark of a great civilization.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Kat Hannah, thank you very much indeed for joining us here. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Emma Searle, Charlie Filmer-Court and Daniel Bache, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Christy Evans, with editing assistance from Holly Fisher. After the headlines, there's music on the way. And then Monocle Reads. Today I speak to Deborah Feltman, who is the creator of the hit Netflix series Unorthodox, which of course comes from her book, her autobiography. And a little after that, I'll be speaking to Robert McCrum about his book Shakespearean and what a role Shakespeare has in really weaving a thread through our common humanity. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.